He owes me 40 quid.
Ah, said Strike. Can't help with that.
The man scuttled off, and Strike closed the door, thanking his lucky stars that he'd had the forethought to provide himself with a cover. All he needed was for the police to be tipped off now, before he could prove anything. He lifted up the orange box, shut off the hissing propane, and then replaced the iPod in its dock on top of the box. About to move deeper into the flat, he had a sudden thought and turned back to the iPod. One delicate poke of his latex-covered forefinger, and the tiny screen lit up. Hot rails to hell, bye, as Strike knew only too well. Blue Oyster Cult.
Chapter 60. Vengeance. The Pact. The club was heaving with people. It had been constructed in two railway arches, just like those opposite his flat, and had a subterranean feel enhanced by the curved corrugated iron roof. A projector was throwing psychedelic lights across the ridges of metal. The music was deafening. They had not been overly keen on letting him in. He'd had a bit of attitude from the bouncers. He had experienced a fleeting fear that they would pat him down, in his jacket, with the knives concealed inside it. He looked older than anybody else he could see, and he resented it. That was what the psoriatic arthritis had done to him, leaving him pockmarked and blown up with steroids. His muscle had run to fat since his boxing days. He had pulled with ease back in Cyprus, but not any more. He knew he'd have no chance with any of these hundreds of giddy little bitches crammed together beneath the glitter ball. Hardly any of them were dressed the way he expected of a club. Many of them were in jeans and t-shirts, like a bunch of lesbians. Where was Strike's temp, with her gorgeous arse and her delicious distractibility? There weren't that many tall black women here. She ought to be easy to spot. Yet he had combed bar and dance floor, and seen no sign of her. It had seemed like providence, her mentioning this club so very close to his flat. He had thought it meant a return of his godlike status, the universe arranging itself once more for his benefit. But that feeling of invincibility had been fleeting and almost entirely dispelled by the argument with it. The music thumped inside his head. He would rather have been back at home, listening to Blue Oyster Cult, masturbating over his relics. But he had heard her planning to be here. Fuck, it was so crowded that he might be able to press up against her and stab her without anyone noticing or hearing her scream. Where was the bitch? The tosser in the wild flag t-shirt had jostled him so many times, he yearned to give him a good kicking. Instead, he elbowed his way out of the bar to look at the dance floor again. The shifting lights panned across a swaying carpet of arms and sweaty faces, a glint of gold, a scarred and sneering mouth. He cleaved his way through onlookers, not caring how many little tarts he knocked aside. That scarred guy had been on the tube. He looked back. The man appeared to have lost someone. He was standing on tiptoe looking all around. There was something wrong. He could feel it. Something fishy. Bending his knees slightly, the better to mingle with the crowd, he forced his way towards a fire exit. Sorry, mate, I need you to use the... Fuck off. He was out of it before anyone could stop him, forcing the bar across the fire door, plunging out into the night. He jogged along the exterior wall and around a corner where, alone, he breathed deeply, considering his options. You're safe, he told himself. You're safe. No one's got anything on you. But was it true? Of all the clubs she could have mentioned, she had chosen the one 2 minutes from his house. What if that had not been a gift from the gods, but something entirely different? What if someone was trying to set him up? No, it couldn't be. Strike had sent the pigs to him and they hadn't been interested. He was safe for sure. There was nothing to connect him to any of them. except that that guy with a scarred face had been on the tube from Finchley. The implications of that temporarily jammed his thought processes. If somebody was following not Donald Lang, but a completely different man, he was totally fucked. He began to walk, every now and then breaking into a short run. The crutches that were so useful a prop were no longer necessary, except for gaining the sympathy of gullible women, fooling the disability office, and, of course, maintaining his cover as a man too sick and ill to go looking for little Kelsey Platt. His arthritis had burned itself out years back, though it had proved a pleasant little earner and kept the flat in Wollaston Close ticking over. Hurrying across the car park, he looked up at his flat. The curtains were closed. He could have sworn he had left them open. Chapter 61. And now the time has come at last to crush the motif of the rose. Blue Oyster Cult, before the kiss. The bulb was out in the only bedroom. Strike turned on the small torch he had brought with him and advanced slowly towards the only piece of furniture, a cheap pine wardrobe. The door creaked as he opened it. The interior was plastered with articles from the newspapers about the Shacklewell Ripper. Taped above all of them was a picture that had been printed on a piece of A4 paper, possibly from the internet. Strike's young mother, naked, arms over her head, her long cloud of dark hair not quite covering her breasts, proudly displayed, an arch of curly script clearly visible over the dark triangle of pubic hair. Mistress of the Salmon Salt. He looked down at the floor of the wardrobe, where a pile of hardcore pornography sat beside a black bin bag. Putting the torch under his arm, Strike opened the letter with his latex-gloved hands. Inside was a small selection of women's underclothing, some of it stiff with old brown blood. At the very bottom of the bag, his fingers closed on a fine chain and a hoop earring. A heart-shaped harp charm glinted in the light of his torch. There was a trace of dry blood on the hoop. Strike replaced everything in the black bin bag, closed the wardrobe door, and continued to the kitchenette, which was clearly the source of the rotting smell that pervaded the entire place. Somebody had turned up the TV next door. An echoing tirade of gunshots sounded through the thin wall. Strike heard faint, stoned laughter. Beside the kettle sat a jar of instant coffee, a bottle of Bell's, a magnifying mirror and a razor. The oven was thick with grease and dust, and looked as though it had not been used for a long time. The fridge door had been wiped down with a dirty cloth that had left behind it sweeping arcs of a pinkish residue. Strike had just reached for the handle when his mobile vibrated in his pocket. Shanker was calling him. They had agreed not to phone each other, but only to text. "Fucking hell. Shanker," said Strike, raising the mobile to his ear. "I thought I said..." He heard the breathing behind him, a bare second before a machete came swinging through the air at his neck. Strike dived sideways, the mobile flying out of his hand, and slipped on the dirty floor. As he fell, the slashing blade sliced into his ear. The hulking shadow raised the machete again to attack Strike as he landed on the floor. Strike kicked out at its crotch, and the killer grunted in pain, backed off a couple of paces, then raised the machete once more. Scrambling to his knees, Strike punched his assailant hard in the balls. The machete slid out of Lang's fingers and fell onto Strike's back, causing him to shout out in pain even as he put his arms around Lang's knees and toppled him. Lang's head collided with the cooker door, but his thick fingers were scrabbling for Strike's throat. Strike tried to land a punch, but was pinned down by Lang's considerable weight. The man's large, powerful hands were closing on his windpipe. With a gigantic effort, Strike mustered enough force to headbutt Lang, whose skull again clanged off the oven door. They rolled over, Strike now on top. He tried to punch Lang in the face, but the other's reactions were as quick as they had been in the ring. One hand deflected the blow, and his other was under Strike's chin, forcing his face upwards. Strike swung again, unable to see where he was aiming, hit bone, and heard it crack. Then Lang's large fist came out of nowhere, bang into the middle of Strike's face, and he felt his nose shatter. Blood spurted everywhere as he rocked backwards with the force of the punch, his eyes watering so that everything blurred. Groaning and panting, Lang threw him off. From nowhere, like a conjurer, he produced a carving knife. Half-blinded, blood pouring into his mouth, Strike saw it glimmer in the moonlight and kicked out with his prosthetic leg. There was a muffled chink of metal on metal as the knife hit the steel rod of his ankle and was raised again.
"No you don't, you fucker!"
Shanka had Lang in a headlock from behind. Ill-advisedly, Strike grabbed for the carving knife and got his palm sliced open. Shanka and Lang were wrestling, the Scot by far the larger of the two, and rapidly getting the better of it. Strike took another powerful kick at the carving knife with his prosthetic foot, and this time knocked it clean out of Lang's hand. Now he could help Shanka wrestle him to the ground.
"Give it up or I'll fucking knife you!"
bellowed Shanka, arms around Lang's neck as the Scot writhed and swore, his heavy fists still clenched, his broken jaw sagging.
"You ain't the only one with a fucking blade, you fat piece of shit!"
Strike tugged out the handcuffs that were the most expensive piece of equipment he had taken away with him from the SIB. It took the combined force of both Strike and Shanka to force Lang into a position where he could be cuffed, securing the thick wrists behind his back, while Lang struggled and swore non-stop. Freed of the necessity to hold Lang down, Shanka kicked him so hard in the diaphragm that the killer emitted a long, faint wheeze and was rendered temporarily speechless.
"You all right, Bunsen? Bunsen, where'd he get you?"
Strike had slumped back against the oven. The cut to his ear was bleeding copiously, as was his slashed right palm, but his rapidly swelling nose troubled him most, because the blood pouring out of it into his mouth was making it difficult to breathe.
"There you go, Bunsen," said Shanka,
returning from a brief search of the small flat with a roll of toilet paper.
"Cheers,"
said Strike thickly. He stuffed his nostrils with as much paper as they would hold, then looked down at Lang.
"Nice to see you again, Ray."
The still-winded Lang said nothing. His bald pate was shining faintly in the moonlight that had illuminated his knife.
"Thought you said his name was Donald?"
asked Shanka curiously, as Lang shifted on the ground. Shanka kicked him in the stomach again.
"It is," said Strike. "And stop bloody kicking him. If you rupture anything, I'll have to answer for it in court."
"So why are you calling him?"
"Because," said Strike. "And don't touch anything either, Shanker. I don't want your fingerprints in here. Because Donnie's been using a borrowed identity." "When he's not here," Strike said, approaching the fridge and putting his left hand with its still intact latex glove on the handle, "he's heroic retired firefighter Ray Williams, who lives in Finchley with Hazel Furley."
Strike pulled open the fridge door and, still using his left hand, opened the freezer compartment. Kelsey Platt's breasts lay inside, dried up now like figs, yellow and leathery. Beside them lay Lila Monkton's fingers, the nails varnished purple, Lang's teeth marks imprinted deeply upon them. At the back lay a pair of severed ears, from which little plastic ice cream cones still hung, and a mangled piece of flesh, in which nostrils were still distinguishable.
"Holy shit,"
said Shanka, who had also bent over to look from behind him.
"Holy shit, Bunsen. They're bits..."
Strike closed both icebox and fridge door and turned to look at his captive. Lang lay quiet now. Strike was sure that he was already using that devious fox-like brain to see how he could work this desperate situation to his advantage,
how he would be able to argue that Strike had framed him, planted or contaminated evidence.
"Should have recognised you, shouldn't I, Donnie?" said Strike, wrapping his right hand in toilet paper to stem the bleeding.
Now, by the dim moonlight falling through the grubby window, Strike could just make out the features of Lang beneath the stones of extra weight that steroids and a lack of regular exercise had packed onto his once thickly muscled frame. His fatness, his dry-lined skin, the beard he had doubtless grown to hide his pockmarks, the carefully shaven head, and the shuffling walk he had affected added up to a man at least 10 years older than his real age.
"Should have recognised you the moment you opened the front door to me at Hazel's," Strike said.
"But you kept your face covered, dabbing away at your fucking tears, didn't you? What had you done? Rub something in 'em to make 'em swell up?"
Strike offered his pack to Shanker before lighting up.
"The Geordie accent was a bit overdone, now I think about it. You'll have picked that up in Gateshead, did you? He's always been a good mimic, our Donnie," he told Shanker. "You should have heard his Corporal Oakley. Life and soul, Donnie was, apparently."
Shanker was staring from Strike to Lang, apparently fascinated. Strike continued to smoke, looking down at Lang. His nose was stinging and throbbing so badly, it was making his own eyes water. He wanted to hear the killer speak, once, before he rang the police.
"Beat up and robbed a demented old lady in Corby, didn't you, Donnie? Poor old Mrs. Williams. You took her son's award for bravery, and I bet you got a good bit of old documentation of his as well. You knew he'd gone abroad. It's not too hard to steal someone's identity if you got a bit of ID to start with. Easy to parlay that into enough current identification to hoodwink a lonely woman and a careless policeman or two."
Lang lay silent on the dirty floor, but Strike could almost feel the frantic workings of his filthy, desperate mind.
"I found Accutane in the house," Strike told Shanker. "It's a drug for acne, but it's for psoriatic arthritis too. I should have known then. He kept it hidden in Kelsey's room. Ray Williams didn't have arthritis. I bet you had lots of little secrets together, didn't you, Donnie? You and Kelsey. Winding her up about me, getting her exactly where you wanted her. Taking her for motorbike rides to lurk near my office, pretending to post letters for her. Bringing her my fake notes."
"You sick bastard," said the disgusted Shanker.
He leaned over Lang with his cigarette tip close to Lang's face, clearly yearning to hurt him.
"You're not burning him either, Shanker," said Strike, pulling out his mobile. "You better get out of here. I'm going to call the cops."
He rang 999 and gave the address. His story would be that he had followed Lang to the club and back to his flat, that there had been an argument and that Lang had attacked him. Nobody needed to know that Shanker had been involved, nor that Strike had picked Lang's locks. Of course, the stone neighbour might talk, but Strike thought it likely that the young man might prefer to stay well out of it, rather than have his sobriety and drug history assessed in a court of law.
"Take all this and get rid of it," Strike told Shanker, peeling off the fluorescent jacket and handing it to him. "And the gas canister through there."
"Right you are, Bunsen. Sure you're going to be all right with him?"
Shanker added, eyes on Strike's broken nose, his bleeding ear and hand.
"Yeah, course I will," said Strike, vaguely touched.
He heard Shanker picking up the metal canister in the next room, and shortly afterwards saw him passing the kitchen window on the balcony outside.
"Shanker!"
His old friend was back in the kitchen so fast that Strike knew he must have sprinted. The heavy gas canister was raised, but Lang still lay handcuffed and quiescent on the floor, and Strike stood smoking beside the cooker.
"Fucking hell, Bunsen, I thought he jumped you."
"Shanker, could you get out of a car and drive me somewhere tomorrow morning? I'll give you..."
Strike looked down at his bare wrist. He had sold his watch yesterday for the cash that had paid for Shanker's help tonight. What else did he have to flog?
"Listen, Shanker, You know I'm going to make money out of this one. Give me a few months and I'll have clients queuing up.
It's all right, Bunsen, said Shanker, after brief consideration. You can own me.
Seriously?
Yeah, said Shanker, turning to go. Give me a bell when you're ready to leave. I'll go get us a car.
Don't nick one, Strike called after him.
Mere seconds after Shanker had passed the window for the second time, Strike heard the distant sound of a police siren.
Here they come, Donnie, he said.
It was then that Donald Lang spoke in his true voice to Strike for the first and last time.
Your mother, he said, in a deep Borders accent, was a fucking whore.
Strike laughed. Maybe so, he said, bleeding and smoking in the darkness as the sirens grew louder.
But she loved me, Donnie. I heard yours didn't give a shit about you, little policeman's bastard that you were.
Lang began to thrash around, trying fruitlessly to free himself, but he merely spun on his side, arms still pinned behind his back. Chapter 62. A red cap before the kiss. Blue Oyster Cult, before the kiss. Strike did not meet Carver that night. He suspected the man would have shot off his own kneecaps rather than face Strike now. A pair of CID officers he had never met interrogated him in a side room in accident and emergency, between the various medical procedures his injuries warranted. His ear had been stitched back together, his slashed palm bandaged, a dressing had been applied to his back, which the falling machete had nicked, and for the third time in his life, his nose had been painfully manipulated back into approximate symmetry. At convenient intervals, Strike had given the police a lucid exposition of the line of reasoning that had led him to Lang. He was careful to tell them that he had phoned that information through to a subordinate of Carver's 2 weeks previously, and had also tried to tell Carver directly the last time they had spoken.
"Why aren't you writing that down?" he asked the officers, who sat in silence, staring at him.
The younger man made a cursory note.
"I also," Strike continued, "wrote a letter and sent it to D.I. Carver, recorded delivery. He should have got it yesterday."
"You sent it recorded delivery," repeated the older of the two officers, a sad-eyed man with a moustache.
"That's right," said Strike. "Thought I'd make sure it was good and hard to lose."
The policeman made a far more detailed note. Strike's story was that, suspecting the police weren't convinced by his suspicions about Lang, he had never stopped watching him. He had followed Lang to the nightclub, worried about whether he was going to try to pick up a woman, then tailed him to his flat, where he had decided to confront him. About Elisa, who had played the part of his temp with such aplomb, and Shanker, whose enthusiastic intervention had certainly spared Strike several more stab wounds, he said nothing.
"The clincher," Strike told the officers, "is going to be finding this guy Richie, sometimes known as Dickie, whose motorbike Lang's been borrowing. Hazel will be able to tell you all about him. He's been giving Lang alibis all over the shop. I reckon he's a petty criminal himself, and probably thought he was just helping Lang cheat on Hazel or do a bit of benefit fraud. He doesn't sound like a smart guy. I think he'll crack pretty quickly once he realizes it was murder."
The doctors and police finally decided that they needed nothing more from Strike at 5 o'clock in the morning. He refused the policeman's offer of a lift, which he suspected was made partly to keep tabs on him as long as they could.
"We wouldn't want this to get out before we've had a chance to speak to the families," said the younger officer, whose white blonde hair stood out in the drab dawn on the forecourt where the three men were taking leave of one another.
"I'm not going to the press," said Strike, yawning widely as he felt in his pockets for his remaining cigarettes. "I've got other stuff to do today."
He had begun to walk away when a thought occurred to him.
What was the church connection? Brockbank. What made Carver think it was him?
Oh, said the moustached officer. He did not seem particularly eager to share the information.
There was a youth worker who transferred from Finchley to Brixton. Didn't lead anywhere, but... He added, with an air of faint defiance, We've got him. Brockbank. Got a tip-off from a homeless hostel yesterday.
Nice one, said Strike.
Press love a paedophile. I'd leave with that when you talk to them.
Neither officer smiled. Strike bade them good morning and left, wondering whether he had any money on him for a taxi, smoking left-handed because the local anaesthetic was wearing off in his right hand, his broken nose stinging in the cool morning air.
Fucking Yorkshire,
Shanker said over the phone when he called to tell Strike he had a car, and the detective had told him where he wanted to go.
Yorkshire?
Massam, Strike had replied.
Look, I've already told you, I'll pay you anything you like when I get the money. It's a wedding, and I don't want to miss it. Time's going to be tight as it is. Anything you like, Shanker, you got my word on it, and I'll pay you when I can.
Who's getting married?
Robin, said Strike.
Ah,
said Shanker. He had sounded pleased.
Yeah, well, in that case, Bunsen, I'll drive you. I told you you shouldn't have...
Yeah.
Elisa told you.
Yeah, she did. Bloody loudly, too.
Strike had a strong suspicion that Shanker was now sleeping with Elisa. He could think of few other explanations for the speed with which he had suggested her when Strike had explained the need for a woman to play a safe but essential part in the entrapment of Donald Lang. She had demanded £100 for doing the job and had assured Strike that it would have been considerably more had she not considered herself deep in his partner's debt.
Shanker, we can talk about all this on the way. I need food and a shower. We're going to be bloody lucky to make it.
So here they were, speeding north in the Mercedes Shanker had borrowed, from where Strike did not inquire. The detective, who had had barely any sleep in the previous couple of nights, dozed for the first 60 miles, waking with a snort only when his mobile buzzed in his suit pocket.
Strike, he said sleepily.
Bloody good job, mate, said Wardle.
His tone did not match his words. After all, Wardle had been in charge of the investigation when Ray Williams had been cleared of all suspicion in relation to Kelsey's death.
Cheers, said Strike. You realise you're now the only copper in London still prepared to talk to me.
Ah, well, said Wardle, rallying slightly. Quality over quantity. I thought you'd like to know. They've already found Richard, and he's sung like a canary.
Richard, mumbled Strike.
He felt as though his exhausted brain had been purged of the details that had obsessed him for months. Trees poured soothingly past the passenger window in a rush of summer greenery. He felt as though he could sleep for days.
Richie, Dickie, motorbike, said Wardle.
Oh, yeah,
said Strike, absent-mindedly scratching his stitched ear, then swearing.
Shit, that hurt. Sorry. He's talked already, has he?
He's not what you call a bright boy, said Wardle. We found a bunch of stolen gear at his place as well.
I thought that might be how Donnie was funding himself. He's always been a handy thief.
There was a little gang of them. Nothing major, just a lot of petty pilfering. Richie was the only one who knew Lang had a double identity. He thought he was working a benefit scam. Lang asked three of them to back him up and pretend their camping trip to Shoreham by Sea had been the weekend he killed Kelsey. Apparently, he told them he had another bird somewhere and Hazel wasn't to know.
He could always get people on side, Lang, said Strike,
remembering the investigating officer in Cyprus who had been so ready to clear him of rape.
How did you realise they weren't there that weekend? Asked Wardle curiously.
They had photos and everything.
How did you know they weren't on the stag the weekend she died?
Oh, said Strike.
See, Holly.
What?
Sea Holly, repeated Strike. Sea Holly isn't in bloom in April.
Summer and autumn, I spent half my childhood in Cornwall. The picture of Lang and Richie on the beach. There was sea holly. I should have realised then, but I kept getting sidetracked.
After Wardle had hung up, Strike stared through the windscreen at the passing fields and trees, thinking back over the past 3 months. He doubted that Lang had ever known about Brittany Brockbank, but he had probably dug around enough to know the story of Whittaker's trial, the quoting of Mistress of the Salmon Salt from the dock. Strike felt as though Lang had laid drag tales for him, without any idea how successful they would be. Shanker turned on the radio. Strike, who would have preferred to go back to sleep, did not complain, but wound down the window and smoked out of it. In the steadily brightening sunshine, he realized that the Italian suit he had pulled on automatically was flecked with small amounts of gravy and red wine. He rubbed off the worst of the dried-on stains, until reminded suddenly of something else.
Oh, fuck.
What's the matter?
I forgot to ditch someone.
Shanker began to laugh. Strike smiled ruefully, which was painful. His whole face ached.
Are we trying to stop this wedding, Bunsen?
Course not, said Strike, pulling out another cigarette. I was invited. I'm a friend.
A guest.
You sect her, said Shanker, which ain't a mark of friendship where I come from.
Strike refrained from pointing out that Shanker knew hardly anyone who had ever had a job.
She's like your mum,
said Shanker, after a long silence.
Who is?
You're Robin. Kind. Wanted to save that kid.
Strike found it difficult to defend a refusal to save a child to a man who had been rescued, bleeding, from the gutter at the age of 16.
Well, I'm going to try and get her back, aren't I? But the next time she calls you, if she calls you...
Yeah, I'll tell you, Bunsen.
The wing mirror showed Strike a face that might have belonged to the victim of a car crash. His nose was enormous and purple, and his left ear looked black. By daylight he saw that his hasty attempt to shave using his left hand had not been entirely successful. As he imagined himself sliding into the back of the church, he realized how conspicuous he was going to be, what a scene it would make if Robin decided she did not want him there. He didn't want to spoil her day. At the first request to leave, he vowed inwardly, he would do so.
Bunsen!
Shouted Shanker excitedly, making Strike jump. Shanker turned up the radio. Arrest has been made in the case of the Shacklewell Ripper. After a thorough search of a flat in Wollaston Close, London, police have charged 34-year-old Donald Lang with the murders of Kelsey Platt, Heather Smart, Martina Rossi, and Sadie Roach, the attempted murder of Lila Monckton, and a serious assault on a sixth, unnamed woman.
They didn't mention you,
said Shanker when the report ended. He sounded disappointed.
They wouldn't,
said Strike, fighting an uncharacteristic nervousness. He had just seen the first sign to Massam.
But they will. Good thing, too. I need the publicity if I'm going to get my business back off the ground.
He automatically checked his wrist, forgetting that there was no watch there, and instead consulted the dashboard clock.
Put your foot down, Shanker. We're going to miss the start as it is.
Strike became increasingly anxious as they approached their destination. The service had been scheduled to start 20 minutes before they finally tore up the hill to Massam, Strike checking his phone for the location of the church.
It's over there, he said,
pointing frantically to the opposite side of the broadest market square he had ever seen, which was packed with people at food stalls. As Shanker drove none too slowly around the periphery of the market, several bystanders scowled, and one man in a flat cloth cap shook his fist at the scarred man driving so dangerously in the sedate heart of Massam.
Park here, anywhere here, said Strike,
spotting two dark blue Bentleys adorned with white ribbons, parked at the far end of the square, the chauffeurs talking with their hats off in the sunshine. They looked around as Shanker braked. Strike threw off his seatbelt. He could see the church spire over the treetops now. He felt almost sick due no doubt to the 40 cigarettes he must have smoked overnight, the lack of sleep, and Shanker's driving. Strike had hurried several steps away from the car before dashing back to his friend.
"Wait for me. I might not be staying."
He hurried away again past the staring chauffeurs, nervously straightened his tie, then remembered the state of his face and suit, and wondered why he bothered. Through the gates and into the deserted churchyard, Strike limped. The impressive church reminded him of St. Dionysius in Market Harborough, back when he and Robin had been friends. The hush over the sleepy, sunlit graveyard felt ominous. He passed a strange, almost pagan-looking column covered in carvings to his right as he approached the heavy oak doors. Grasping the handle with his left hand, he paused for a second.
"Fuck it," he breathed to himself, and opened it as quietly as he could.
The smell of roses met him. White roses of Yorkshire, blooming in tall stands and hanging in bunches at the ends of the packed queues. A thicket of brightly coloured hats stretched away towards the altar. Hardly anybody looked around at Strike as he shuffled inside, although those that did stared. He edged along the rear wall, staring at the far end of the aisle. Robin was wearing a coronet of white roses in her long, wavy hair. He could not see her face. She was not wearing her cast. Even at this distance, he could see the long purple scar running down the back of her forearm.
"Do you?" came a ringing voice from an unseen vicar. "Robin Venetia Ellicott, take this man, Matthew John Cunliffe, to be your lawful wedded husband, to have and to hold, from this day forward."
Exhausted, tense, his gaze fixed on Robin, Strike had not realized how near he was to the flower arrangement that stood on a fine tulip-like bronze stand.
"For better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health, until death..."
"Oh, shit," said Strike.
The arrangement he had hit toppled as though in slow motion, and fell with a deafening clang to the floor. Congregation and couple turned and looked back.
"Christ, I'm sorry,"
said Strike hopelessly. Somewhere in the middle of the congregation, a man laughed. Most returned their gazes to the altar at once, but a few guests continued to stare at Strike before remembering themselves.
"Do you part?"
said the vicar, with saintly tolerance. The beautiful bride, who had not once smiled in the entire service, was suddenly beaming.
"I do,"
said Robin in a ringing voice, looking straight into the eyes, not of her stony-faced new husband, but of the battered and blooded man who had just sent her flowers, crashing to the floor. This has been a Hachette audio production of Career of Evil, written by Robert Galbraith, read by Robert Glenister, directed by Garrick Hagan, produced by Nicholas Jones, recorded at Strathmore Publishing, Clerkenwell, London, post-production by Wolfgang Dienst. Selected Blue Oyster Cult lyrics 1967 to 1994 by kind permission of Sony ATV Music Publishing UK Limited. www.BlueOysterCult.com. Don't Fear the Reaper, the best of Blue Oyster Cult, from Sony Music Entertainment Inc., available now via iTunes and all usual musical retail outlets. Career of Evil is also available in print and digital formats from Little Brown and Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Text copyright 2015 by J.K. Rowling. Audio production copyright 2015, Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. In accordance with the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, the duplicating, uploading, and electronic sharing of any part of this audiobook, without the permission of the publisher, constitutes unlawful piracy and theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, prior written permission must be obtained by contacting the publisher at permissions
hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales, is entirely coincidental. Acknowledgements. I can't remember ever enjoying writing a novel more than Career of Evil. This is odd, not only on account of the grisly subject matter, but also because I've rarely been busier than over the last 12 months and have had to keep switching between projects, which is not my favourite way to work. Nevertheless, Robert Galbraith has always felt like my own private playground, and he didn't let me down on this occasion. I have to thank my usual team for ensuring that my once secret identity remains such fun. My peerless editor, David Shelley, who has now been godfather to four of my novels and who makes the editing process so rewarding. My wonderful agent and friend, Neil Blair, who has been Robert's stalwart supporter from the first. DB and SOBE, who have allowed me to pick their military brains clean. The backdoor man, for reasons best left undisclosed. Amanda Donaldson, Fiona Shapcott, Angela Milne, Christine Collingwood, Simon Brown, Kaiza Tiensu and Danny Cameron, without whose hard work I would not have any time left over to do my own, and the dream team of Mark Hutchinson, Nikki Stonehill and Rebecca Salt, without whom I would frankly be a wreck. Particular thanks are due to MP, who enabled me to make a fascinating visit to 35 Section SIB UK RMP in Edinburgh Castle. Thanks are also due to the two policewomen who didn't arrest me for taking photographs of the perimeter of a nuclear facility in Barrow-in-Furness. To all the lyricists who have worked with and for Blue Oyster Cult, thank you for writing such great songs and for letting me use some of your words in this novel. To my children, Decca, Davy and Kens, I love you beyond words and I want to thank you for being so understanding about the times when the writing bug is particularly active. Lastly and mostly, thank you, Neil. Nobody helped more when it came to this book. Career of Evil. Words by Patti Smith. Music by Patti Smith and Albert Bouchard. Copyright 1974. Reproduced by permission of Sony ATV Tunes LLC, London W1F 9LD. This Ain't the Summer of Love. Words and music by Albert Bouchard, Murray Krugman and Donald Waller, copyright 1975. Reproduced by permission of Sony, ATV Music Publishing UK Limited, Sony ATV Tunes LLC, London W1F 9LD. Madness to the Method, words and music by D. Trismond and Donald Rosa, copyright 1985. Reproduced by permission of Sony ATV Music Publishing UK Limited, Sony ATV Tunes LLC, London W1F 9LD. The Marshall Plan. Words and music by Albert Bouchard, Joseph Bouchard, Eric Bloom, Alan Lanier, and Donald Rosa. Copyright 1980. Reproduced by permission of Sony ATV Music Publishing UK Limited, Sony ATV Tunes LLC, London W1F 9LD. Mistress of the Salmon Salt, Quicklime Girl. Words and music by Albert Bouchard and Samuel Perlman. Copyright 1973. Reproduced by permission of Sony ATV Tunes LLC, London W1F 9LD. Astronomy. Words and music by Albert Bouchard, Joseph Bouchard and Samuel Perlman. Copyright 1974. Reproduced by permission of Sony ATV Music Publishing UK Limited, Sony ATV Tunes LLC, London W1F 9LD. Revenge of Vera Gemini. Words by Patti Smith. Music by Albert Bouchard and Patti Smith. Copyright 1976. Reproduced by permission of Sony ATV Music Publishing UK Limited, Sony ATV Tunes LLC, London W1F 9LD. Flaming Telepaths. Words and music by Albert Bouchard, Eric Bloom, Samuel Perlman and Donald Rosa. Copyright 1974. Reproduced by permission of Sony ATV Music Publishing UK Limited, Sony ATV Tunes LLC, London W1F 9LD. Good to Feel Hungry. Eric Bloom, Danny Miranda, Donald B. Rosa, Bobby Rondinelli, John P. Shirley. Reproduced by permission of Six Pound Dog Music and Triceratops Music. Lonely Teardrops, Words and Music by Alan Lanier. Copyright 1980. Reproduced by permission of Sony ATV Music Publishing UK Limited, Sony ATV Tunes LLC, London W1F 9LD. One Step Ahead of the Devil, Eric Bloom, Danny Miranda, Donald B. Rosa, Bobby Rondinelli, John P. Shirley. Reproduced by permission of Six Pound Dog Music and Triceratops Music. Shadow of California. Words and music by Samuel Perlman and Donald Rosa. Copyright 1983. Reproduced by permission of Sony ATV Music Publishing UK Limited. Sony ATV Tunes LLC. London W1F 9LD. OD'd on Life Itself. Words and music by Albert Bouchard, Eric Bloom, Samuel Perlman and Donald Rosa. Copyright 1973. Reproduced by permission of Sony ATV Music Publishing UK Limited. Sony ATV Tunes LLC. London W1F 9LD. In the Presence of Another World. Words and music by Joseph Bouchard and Samuel Perlman. Copyright 1988. Reproduced by permission of Sony ATV Music Publishing UK Limited. Sony ATV Tunes LLC. London W1F 9LD. Showtime. Eric Bloom, John P. Trivers. Reproduced by permission of Six Pound Dog Music. Power Underneath Despair, Eric Bloom, Donald B. Rosa, John P. Shirley. Reproduced by permission of Six Pound Dog Music. Before the Kiss, words and music by Donald Rosa and Samuel Perlman. Copyright 1972. Reproduced by permission of Sony, ATV Music Publishing UK Limited. Sony ATV Tunes LLC, London W1F 9LD. Words taken from Here's Te Melrose by Jack Drummond, Zoo Music Limited. The Girl That Love Made Blind, lyrics by Albert Bouchard. Lips in the Hills, words and music by Eric Bloom, Donald Rosa and Richard Meltzer, copyright 1980. Reproduced by permission of Sony, ATV Music Publishing UK Limited, Sony ATV Tunes LLC, London W1F 9LD. Workshop of the Telescopes, Albert Bouchard, Alan Lanier, Donald Rosa, Eric Bloom, Sandy Perlman. Debbie Denise, words by Patti Smith. Music by Albert Bouchard and Patti Smith, copyright 1976. Reproduced by permission of Sony, ATV Music Publishing UK Limited, Sony ATV Tunes LLC, London W1F 9LD. Live For Me, Donald B. Rosa, John P. Shirley, reproduced by permission of Triceratops Music. I Just Like to Be Bad, Eric Bloom, Brian Neumeister, John P. Shirley. Reproduced by permission of Six Pound Dog Music. Make Rock, Not War. Words and music by Robert Sidney Halligan Jr., copyright 1983. Reproduced by permission of Screen Gems EMI Music Inc., EMI Music Publishing Limited, London W1F 9LD. Hammerback, Eric Bloom, Donald B. Rosa, John P. Shirley. Reproduced by permission of Six Pound Dog Music and Triceratops Music. Death Valley Nights, words and music by Albert Bouchard and Richard Meltzer. Copyright 1977. Reproduced by permission of Sony ATV Music Publishing UK Limited. Sony ATV Tunes LLC. London W1F 9LD. Outward Bound. A Song for the Grammar School, Barrow in Furness. Words by Dr. Thomas Wood. Tenderloin. Words and music by Alan Lanier. Copyright 1976. Reproduced by permission of Sony ATV Music Publishing UK Limited, Sony ATV Tunes LLC, London W1F 9LD. After Dark, Words and music by Eric Bloom, L. Myers and John Trivers. Copyright 1981. Reproduced by permission of Sony, ATV Music Publishing UK Limited, Sony ATV Tunes LLC, London W1F 9LD. Don't Fear the Reaper, words and music by Donald Rosa. Copyright 1976. Reproduced by permission of Sony, ATV Music Publishing UK Limited, Sony ATV Tunes LLC, London W1F 9LD. She's as beautiful as a foot, Albert Bouchard, Richard Meltzer, Alan Lanier. The Vigil, words and music by Donald Rosa and S. Rosa. Copyright 1979. Reproduced by permission of Sony, ATV Music Publishing UK Limited, Sony ATV Tunes LLC, London W1F 9LD. Dominance and Submission, Albert Bouchard, Eric Bloom, Sandy Perlman. Black Blade, words and music by Eric Bloom, John Trivers, and Michael Moorcock. Copyright 1980. Reproduced by permission of Sony ATV Music Publishing UK Limited, Sony ATV Tunes LLC, and Action Green Music Limited, EMI Music Publishing Limited, London W1F 9LD. Dance on Stilts, Donald B. Rosa, John P. Shirley. Reproduced by permission of Triceratops Music. Out of the Darkness, Eric Bloom, Danny Miranda, Donald Rosa, John D. Shirley. Reproduced by permission of Six Pound Dog Music and Triceratops Music. Searching for Celine, words and music by Alan Lanier, copyright 1977. Reproduced by permission of Sony, ATV Music Publishing UK Limited, Sony ATV Tunes LLC, London W1F 9LD. Burning for You, words and music by Donald Rosa and Richard Meltzer, copyright 1981. Reproduced by permission of Sony, ATV Music Publishing UK Limited, Sony ATV Tunes LLC, London W1F 9LD. Still Burning, Donald B. Rosa, John S. Rogers. Reproduced by permission of Triceratops Music. Then Came the Last Days of May, words and music by Donald Rosa, copyright 1972. Reproduced by permission of Sony, ATV Music Publishing UK Limited, Sony ATV Tunes LLC, London W1F 9LD. Harvester of Eyes, words and music by Eric Bloom, Donald Rosa and Richard Meltzer, copyright 1974. Reproduced by permission of Sony, ATV Music Publishing UK Limited, Sony ATV Tunes LLC, London W1F 9LD. Subhuman, Eric Bloom, Sandy Perlman. Doctor Music, words and music by Joseph Bouchard, R. Meltzer, Donald Rosa, copyright 1979. Reproduced by permission of Sony, ATV Music Publishing UK Limited, Sony ATV Tunes LLC, London W1F 9LD. Harvest Moon, Donald Rosa. Reproduced by permission of Triceratops Music. Here Comes That Feeling, Donald B. Rosa, Dick Trisman. Reproduced by permission of Triceratops Music. Celestial the Queen, words and music by Joseph Bouchard and H. Robbins, copyright 1977. Reproduced by permission of Sony, ATV Music Publishing UK Limited, Sony ATV Tunes LLC, London W1F 9LD. Don't Turn Your Back, words and music by Alan Lanier and Donald Rosa, copyright 1981. Reproduced by permission of Sony, ATV Music Publishing UK Limited, Sony ATV Tunes LLC, London W1F 9LD. X-Ray Eyes, Donald B. Rosa, John P. Shirley. Reproduced by permission of Triceratops Music. Veteran of the Psychic Wars, words and music by Eric Bloom and Michael Moorcock, copyright 1981. Reproduced by permission of Sony, ATV Music Publishing UK Limited, Sony ATV Tunes LLC, and Action Green Music Limited, EMI Music Publishing Limited, London W1F 9LD. Spy in the House of the Night, Words and Music by Richard Meltzer and Donald Rosa, copyright 1985. Reproduced by permission of Sony, ATV Music Publishing UK Limited, Sony ATV Tunes LLC, London W1F 9LD. Vengeance the Pact, Words and Music by Albert Bouchard and Joseph Bouchard, copyright 1981. Reproduced by permission of Sony, ATV Music Publishing UK Limited, Sony ATV Tunes LLC, London W1F 9LD. Soul Survivor, Words and Music by Eric Bloom, L. Myers and John Trivers, copyright 1981. Reproduced by permission of Sony, ATV Music Publishing UK Limited, Sony ATV Tunes LLC, London W1F 9LD. Deadline, Donald Rosa. This has been a Hachette audio production. Acknowledgements. I can't remember ever enjoying writing a novel more than Career of Evil. This is odd, not only on account of the grisly subject matter, but also because I've rarely been busier than over the last 12 months and have had to keep switching between projects, which is not my favourite way to work. Nevertheless, Robert Galbraith has always felt like my own private playground, and he didn't let me down on this occasion. I have to thank my usual team for ensuring that my once secret identity remains such fun. My peerless editor, David Shelley, who has now been godfather to four of my novels and who makes the editing process so rewarding. My wonderful agent and friend, Neil Blair, who has been Robert's stalwart supporter from the first. DB and SOBE, who have allowed me to pick their military brains clean. The backdoor man, for reasons best left undisclosed. Amanda Donaldson, Fiona Shapcott, Angela Milne, Christine Collingwood, Simon Brown, Kaiza Tiensu and Danny Cameron, without whose hard work I would not have any time left over to do my own, and the dream team of Mark Hutchinson, Nikki Stonehill and Rebecca Salt, without whom I would frankly be a wreck. Particular thanks are due to MP, who enabled me to make a fascinating visit to 35 Section SIB UK RMP in Edinburgh Castle. Thanks are also due to the two policewomen who didn't arrest me for taking photographs of the perimeter of a nuclear facility in Barrow-in-Furness. To all the lyricists who have worked with and for Blue Oyster Cult, thank you for writing such great songs and for letting me use some of your words in this novel. To my children, Decca, Davy and Kens, I love you beyond words and I want to thank you for being so understanding about the times when the writing bug is particularly active. Lastly and mostly, thank you, Neil. Nobody helped more when it came to this book.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.